This episode is supported by FX's Clipped, the scandalous story of the 2014 Clippers owner's racist remarks captured on tape and heard around the world. The series charts the tape's impact on a dysfunctional basketball organization striving to win against their reputation as the most cursed team in the league. Starring Lawrence Fishburne, Jackie Weaver, Cleopatra Coleman, and Ed O'Neill. FX's Clipped, streaming June 4th, only on Hulu.
Hello, welcome back to More Than a Muse podcast. I'm Sadie.
And I'm Stani.
And I'm excited. I get to talk about another artist.
I know.
Even though everyone heard from me last week. But yeah, I'm really excited. I found this story like a long time ago and it's insane.
It's okay. One of those people that I'm like, she should be in our common vernacular more, you know, and yet not.
And yet she's not.
Nope. It's actually funny. I saw a reference to her this week. I don't remember what it was, but someone was talking about exchanging favors for something.
Okay.
And they're like, I feel like Mata Hari. And I was like, oh, wait a second.
That's I know who
we're
that
talking
is.
About.
Wait, what kind of artist?
Mata
is she?
Hari. She is a dancer.
Ooh.
But she did the exotic form of dancing cool. for most of her career. And so she's like very synonymous with the femme fatale thing and everything. And then also it was during World War One. She actually was like convicted and condemned and put to death by the French army. But it's mainly because they just needed a scapegoat. A lot of people don't even think that she was guilty of anything. And they just needed someone to blame a bunch of stuff on.
I'm not going to lie. You just provided a great elevator pitch for the rest yeah. of the episode. I
well,
am
good.
Very looking forward to this.
Yeah, that was the hope. Because that's what I saw originally was exotic dancer who was convicted by firing squad in France. And I was like, what the heck?
Yeah,
oh my gosh. So that's her. But yeah, is there anything we need to talk about before we start in? I always feel like we get so excited to talk about these people. And then I'm like, oh, crap.
What
you
else?
Did a half marathon.
Oh, I did. I did.
Yeah.
And I've seen like some funny memes of like girl does a half marathon and doesn't tell anyone about it. And it's impossible because like the joke is if anyone does a half marathon, they will tell everyone about it.
Oh, yeah.
But here's the thing. I didn't do it very fast. And for the first 3.5-4 miles, I just listened to I Can Do It With a Broken Heart on repeat.
Nice.
And you want to know what? It was effective.
Yeah.
And I did it. It was fun.
There you go.
I started this year not even in a little bit of shape.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really train as good as I should have, but I am in better shape than I was in January.
Yeah,
so
there you go.
Taking that as a win.
Hey, that's all it takes. I've been doing boxing classes, and a couple weeks ago, I went up to eat dinner with my parents, and my mom was like, your legs look like really toned.
Nice.
And I was like, oh, thank you. Like, it must be from all those ridiculous squats we do every week.
That'll do it.
Yep.
Listen. And I saw another funny tweet of like, why do all my friends in their 20s just start running half marathons?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I thought that was pretty funny. But then also I quote tweeted it because I was like, valid. But also I now am like, wait, I actually didn't think I could do that. And then I did it. So now I like want to do it faster and I want to do it stronger. It actually has helped my confidence a little bit to be like, oh, wait, I can do things that I didn't think I can do. And it's good to have reminders of that consistently in your life. So now I'm like, I want to do it again, but faster. And now I want bigger muscles and I want to be strong and fast. And you know what I mean?
That's
like,
awesome.
It's doing good things for my brain,
no,
actually.
No, I saw like a story about that where a girl like started running during COVID and then she like went and ran a half marathon and like barely finished. And then they showed her now and she like is sponsored and like runs for... Yeah, and it was just like, she just got attached to it and went from there.
And I'm not saying my whole personality is about to become running, but I do, like I said, it was like a nice reminder that it's like, oh, I can do things that I don't think that I can do originally.
I love that.
It's a good reminder.
Yeah, I hate running, so I will not be running a half marathon at any time. But
that's, you know what? That's very valid.
Yeah.
Actually, if anyone ever decides to run a race, I would recommend the Nashville one because it's really just all throughout the city.
Oh,
and
true.
There's a lot of hills, which sucks, but also a lot of people make an event of being on the, like, along the path and, like, mm-hmm. holding up signs. And it's just really funny. Honestly, the vibe's great. There's so many people
That's so nice.
Cheering you on with signs and everything. So it's actually a pretty wholesome vibe.
And I love that.
I would recommend it.
I was about to say, it was like, oh, like, Nashville probably is way better to run in than Utah, because even like 5K here, you're going to run into some hills.
Actually, you would be surprised. There are a lot of hills in Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
And it was not fun. But yeah, I honestly was just there for a good time. I wasn't there for a fast time. And I literally got my phone out and was like taking pictures of the funny signs on the way. Having a great time.
You did it. That's all that matters.
That's all that matters. Also, one last thing before we dive into the story today. If anyone's a Chapel Roan fan, Stani has some stellar Chapel Roan merch on her Etsy. We spent a lot of time promoting our own merch last month. And we spend a lot of time promoting other artists. So I'm going to do the spotlight for today. And I'm going to say, Stani has some great Chapel Roan merch on Etsy. It's when I have room in my budget, I will be purchasing both or a couple of the designs. They're great.
No, they've been fun. I know she's got so popular after her Coachella performance, which I love to see. But at the same time, I'm always a little brokenhearted when that happens.
When they blow up.
Wait, no, but this was my cool thing that I knew about. Yeah, but I'm really excited for her. And so it was fun to... People are searching for a bunch of t-shirts for her right now. And
you got some great designs.
I was happy to accommodate. Yeah, I have one on right now.
Yes, if you're watching on YouTube, you can literally see... ultra modern girl.
Yep. And then they've got Pink Pony Club and Feminomenon. Probably more to come because they're fun. Her lyrics are so fun. So exact opposite of TTPD and vibes. So when I'm getting a little too down, then it's okay, rise and fall.
Switch to Chapel Roan the Midwest Princess. Absolutely. Yeah.
Get hyped up again and then we can move over to sad once more.
Yep. I feel that. Anyways, that's everything I think we need to touch on today.
Cool.
But I would love to learn more about this artist.
Yes, let's talk about her. Okay, Mata Hari. So her name actually was originally Margaretha Gertruda McLeod, and she was born in August of 1876 in the Netherlands. So she's Dutch. Okay, there's definitely some cultural appropriation going on from her because she definitely pretended to be more of an exotic dancer, not like Dutch as well. So she was like pretending to be more, I think, Middle Eastern, I guess is what I would say.
But it
wasn't uncommon back then. We've talked about it a lot with a lot of different people that we've covered where they pretended to be a different race if they had the right look for it. Just because it was easier sometimes than just being European. So that definitely was her. She was the eldest of four children, and she had three younger brothers, which only girl in the family. And they affectionately called her Magritte her whole life. That was like her nickname. And there was a lot. Oh, here we go. So a lot of people assumed that she was either partially Jewish, Malaysian, Javanese, like Indonesian. None of that's true. Like, she has no Jewish and Asian ancestry, nothing. Like, she's just European. Dutch. Yeah, yep. She's just Dutch. So, yeah, but she had that look, ethically ambiguous, so she got away with it.
She capitalized on that.
Yeah. Her father owned a hat shop, which he was able to do by some investments that he had made in the oil industry early on. And then, obviously, oil industry during that time period, a great business to be in. And so they had a pretty good life. She had a very lavish early childhood. They went to some exclusive schools until she was like 13-ish. So like pretty great, rich childhood. And then her father went bankrupt in 1880. And things went downhill fast. Mm. Her parents actually divorced. So they did not survive the bankruptcy. And her mother actually died only 2 years later. Oh. I don't know what from, but 1891, her mother passed away. And then her father remarried in Amsterdam 2 years later, and the family just fell apart after that. Didn't survive everything that had happened.
Margarita was sent to live with her godfather in Sneek, which I'm going to look. I'm pretty sure that's still in the Netherlands.
Okay, yeah, cool. I have no idea.
Yeah, it's just a city in the Netherlands. So they sent her off there, and she was actually studying to become a kindergarten teacher, very different from what she ended up doing. But what happened is that the headmaster started flirting with her, and her godfather removed her from the institution because it was inappropriate, and they got worried. And so then a few months later, she ended up fleeing to her uncle's home in The Hague. Your boss flirts with you, and it ruins your life. I think she enjoyed.
Just to say it ruined her life, but it is very sad that the reason why. It's not like it was her own personal choice at that time to change what she wanted to do with her life. She had a path. She was working towards something. And because of another older, creepy man, she had to find something else. And you know what? Who's to say? Maybe she would have hated being a kindergarten teacher. Besides the point. It's gross.
And it's very sad. And it's just sad too, because it wasn't even like her choice. It seems like her godfather just pulled her out because he was like, this is
to avoid the scandal.
Yeah. And it's that's not really fair either. So she was only 18 at this point, and she answered an advertisement in a Dutch newspaper that was placed by a Dutch colonial army captain who was living in what was then the Dutch East Indies, which is now Indonesia. Gets a little confusing when all of the countries used to belong to each other more than they do now.
Yeah.
But I think they mention it in like Pirates of the Caribbean, the Dutch East India Trading Company. That was the epicenter of a lot of that. And so that's where they were. And he was looking for a wife. And so she answered the advertisement and was basically like a mail order. He was the son of Captain John Breeren McLeod, which apparently it was like a pretty prominent family. And so by marrying him, it allowed her to move into the Dutch upper class and then finally put her finances back on like a sound footing again. So it was like a strategic move, but it worked out, allowed her to be stable. And so she moved with her husband to Malang on the east side of the island of Java, traveling out of SS Princess Amelia. And they ended up having two children together named Norman John and Louise. However, the marriage overall was a disappointment. When you answer a newspaper advertisement for Rudolph was an alcoholic. He also was abusive. He blamed her often for his lack of promotion, which why would that have anything to do with her, and openly kept a concubine, which was a socially accepted practice in the Dutch East Indies. However, not socially acceptable in most social circles.
Yeah.
So I'm sure she wasn't a big fan of that. She did abandon him temporarily and moved in with the Van Reeds, which was another Dutch officer. Mm-hmm. And she ended up studying Indonesian culture intensely for several months and joined a local dance company there to just learn some skills, make some friends. And in correspondence to her relatives in the Netherlands, she revealed that she had an artistic name of Matahari, which was the word for sun in the local Malay language. It literally means like eye of the day. It's like sunshine. Mm-hmm. And that was a name that she had adopted in like the dancing scene there. Like I said, she moved out, but then Rudolph urged her to come back. And so she did. His behavior didn't change. And so she ended up like trying to escape more and more into the local culture to avoid him and her circumstances as much as possible. Sadly, her children both fell violently ill from the treatment of syphilis that they contracted from their parents. And the family claimed that an irate servant poisoned them.
Whoa.
But that wasn't the case. It literally was syphilis. And so one of the children actually did pass away. Their son, Norman, did, and Jeanne was able to survive. But yeah, Rudolph continued to claim that his enemies poisoned their supper to kill their children or something.
Whew.
But they're pretty sure that it's just syphilis. But horrible. So she lost one of her kids.
That is so sad.
And then they both ended up moving back to the Netherlands and officially separating in 1902. The divorce took years, I think, just because it was really uncommon. But it was finalized in 1906.
And then Margarita was awarded custody of their daughter, and Rudolf was legally required to pay child support, but he never did.
Oh, that's weird. That's an unlikely thing for a man to do.
I know. Or not. I would have been, honestly, I would have been more surprised if he did, which is so sad. Yes. But in all these stories we read, and I'm not saying that's common for every guy, but just a lot of these stories we've read about that time period and marriages like that.
Yeah.
If he wasn't even able to uphold the promises they made within their marriage, how is he going to uphold paying money for his child after? What makes it even worse is once when her daughter went to visit her father, she never came back.
What?
Yep. And Margarita didn't have the resources to fight the situation. And so she was like hoping that Rudolf, even though he had been an abusive husband, would be a good father, because he had been, like, he had always been nicer to the children. So she was like, okay, we'll just let it go. She didn't have a lawyer. Women didn't have a lot of rights back then, even when it did come to custody. And so it's just this horrible situation. Jeanne sadly ended up dying at age 21. And they think it was from complications related to the syphilis that she had contracted as a child. So she didn't live much longer herself. So yeah, really sad beginning to all of this. So during the middle of their separation, right before their divorce was finalized, she moved to Paris and actually started there as a circus horse rider.
Okay.
And she used the name Lady McLeod, which the Dutch McLeods were very upset about because that was her husband's surname, McLeod. They were really mad. And also because it was hard to make a living only being a circus horse rider, she also posed as an artist model. So there's probably a lot of paintings out there of her that we don't know about. By 1904, so only a year later, she actually rose to prominence as an exotic dancer. She was a contemporary of dancers like Isadora Duncan, who we talked about, and Ruth St. Denis, who were leaders in early modern dance. And they looked a lot of the time during that time period to like Asia and Egypt for a lot of inspiration. And so she, with her studies that she had done in Indonesian dance, she was doing really well for herself. She also was very promiscuous and flirtatious. She was willing to openly flaunt her body. And so she captivated audiences and was basically an overnight success. She had a debut at the Musée Wormée, I think is how you say it, on March 13th, 1905. And after that, things just took off for her.
Amazing.
Which, good for her. After the start of life sounded pretty horrible.
Yeah.
The rest of it got at least easier for a while. She actually became the long-term mistress of a millionaire who was named Emile Guimet, and he founded the Musée where she was like dancing.
Okay.
And then it was a really common practice at the time to invent a colorful story about your origins, to have some backstory of something sensational. And so she posed as a Javanese princess of Hindu birth who had, pretending to be immersed in the art of sacred Indian dance since childhood. And she started posing for a lot of nude photographs as well during this time, which paid better than the clothed ones. And a lot of these pictures were apparently obtained by her ex, and it strengthened his case to keep custody, even though she couldn't fight it anyway. But yeah, she was trying to get her daughter back for a while. And he was like, look, my ex is in these nude photographs, so she's not a good mom. I was like, no, it just means she's financially stable because you won't pay child support. She had a really famous style. She was really carefree and provocative. And so a lot of people just really enjoyed watching her dance. Another thing that I think is funny is it was like what she became really famous for was like progressively shedding her clothing until all she had left on was like her bra and then like some head ornaments and stuff. And that's like such a common thing now, like even in movies, like the striptease and everything. She's the one who pioneered that. Something that's really funny is that she actually never went bare chested. because she was really self-conscious about her breast size. And so she always kept her breastplate on.
Interesting.
Yeah. And also early in her career, she would wear like a body stocking, which was common sometimes. It was the color of her skin. So she was never actually completely nude. But then later she got more comfortable. She just got rid of it. Anyway, one thing that was interesting. So her act was also really successful because it started elevating erotic dance to a more respectable status. And this style of entertainment became like world famous in Paris. Like it was one of the things that Paris was known for in those days. And she was like willing to do this form of dance that a lot of people weren't willing to do. Yeah. And so it allowed it to spread faster because she was willing to. So then she became really famous for it because she would do it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So she would like also pose for provocative photos, and then she mingled in these really wealthy circles. And a lot of Europeans at the time were really unfamiliar with the Dutch East Indies. And so they were like, oh, she's really exotic because she's from the Dutch East Indies and like all this stuff.
Yep.
And so, and because she had studied the culture and lived there for so long, her claims were accepted as genuine. So no one questioned her stories because no one knew any better. And also she had been there. She knew the culture enough that like it
she could
passed.
Process it very well. Yeah.
Yeah. One enthusiastic French journalist wrote in a Paris newspaper that Maudie Harry was so feline, extremely feminine, majestically tragic, the thousand curves and movements of her body trembling in a thousand rhythms. So that was a review from her dance.
Amazing.
Another journalist in Vienna wrote that after seeing one of her performances, that she was slender and tall with the flexible grace of a wild animal and with blue black hair, and that her face makes a strange foreign impression.
Okay.
Yeah. Which I'm like, what does that mean?
But like that is problematic, but okay.
Yep. But they just thought she was so exotic, which is really funny. Of course, a couple of years later, I think a lot of imitators had arisen, which happens every time something becomes popular, people start imitating it. And so critics began to say that the dazzling features of her were due to cheap exhibitionism and that they lacked any artistic merit. And although she continued to schedule really important social events throughout Europe, she was disdained from some of like cultural institutions as a dancer because they said that she didn't know how to dance. She did. Like, she was very educated in Indonesian style dance, but like, she wouldn't be able to run in those same circles as like Isadora Duncan or Louis Fuller because they were like, you're an exotic dancer.
So it was definitely not taken seriously.
Yeah. Which I know is something that still happens today when you look at like exotic dancers today, and yet they're doing stuff that is insane. There's literally fitness classes based on the same techniques because it is ridiculous the amount of muscles that they have. Mm-hmm. And the fact that they're doing it all in stilettos is just insane. So it's like crazy that it's still considered not actual dancing when it's, yeah, it is. Yeah. So anyway.
Honestly, it's like a conversation we talk about all the time of just high art or high brow versus low brow. And it's very interesting. Yeah. How often people really just want to put down what they deem as the lesser form of their own artwork.
Yeah.
In reality, it's no.
Yeah.
The Venn diagram is almost a circle.
Yes. It still requires all the same things that you consider, but just because it's for a different audience that you deem less respectable, then you're not going to allow. And it's not okay. It's still dancing, regardless of how you look at it. It's still an insane feat. Like athletic strength. So, yeah. But because of all of that, the imitations, everything else, the backlash against it all, her career ended up going into decline after 1912. On March 13th in 1915, she actually performed the last show of her career. Because she began her career relatively late as a dancer, I guess in like her 20s, which sadly is considered late for dancing. She had started putting on weight, which is normal as women age. I will say that a million times.
Absolutely.
However, by this time, she, because of like the nature of her dance, she became more successful for courtesan services. And so she was known more for her sensuality and eroticism and then her classical beauty. And with all of the relationships she had made with like high ranking military officers, politicians, and other people who were in really influential positions, she had a career without having to perform anymore.
Okay. Yeah.
A different kind of performance, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
She was still pretending to be someone else, but just not on stage. So these relationships were like really powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's something people brought up before is that she was in the rooms with the most powerful people at the time. If anyone knows the secrets, it's definitely her, because especially like people would view women in those positions as invisible. Mm-hmm. But no, she was in every room.
Like, and she probably knew very much what was going on.
Oh, yeah. And these powerful men were also taking her frequently across international borders constantly. Mm-hmm. And so they just viewed her as an artist, a bohemian. But then eventually war is approaching. She's in the room with all these powerful people, start getting a little nervous by all of these relationships she has. And so they start viewing her as a promiscuous woman or a dangerous seductress. So it's not as fun when you realize that all of the politicians and all of the military leaders are talking to the same person.
Yeah.
They're like, maybe we made her too powerful. World War One happens, right? And the Netherlands remained neutral. And because of this, she was able to actually cross national borders freely because they weren't on any side, because she's a Dutch citizen, right? Mm-hmm. But to avoid the battlefields, she was traveling between mainly France and the Netherlands via Spain and Britain. And because of this, she's going through four major countries during a world war, the First World War. So there's no precedent for this. It started drawing a lot of attention. Also, during the war, she was in a very intense romantic sexual relationship with Captain Maslov, who was like this 23-year-old Russian staff captain of the 1st Infantry Regiment of the French. She actually ended up describing him as the love of her life, but he was a part of this 50,000-strong Russian expeditionary force sent to the Western Front. I don't know a lot about World War One, you guys. I'm sorry. So I'm like, cool.
Yeah, sounds important. I don't know a lot about World War One either, I admit. Yeah.
But she loved him, and he was wounded fighting in the German-controlled Bremen mountain range. So he actually lost sight in his left eye during this battle. And so she asked for permission to go and visit him in the hospital. And as a citizen of a neutral country, they normally wouldn't allow her near the front of the battlefield, because then you're like putting some weird things there where she's at the front lines, but she's of an opposing force, but then she's supposed to be neutral, if that makes sense. Yeah. Okay. So it's like a thing. But she was met by agents from the basically I'm guessing it's the equivalent of the FBI, but for France.
Okay.
It's like their Brura. Why is that such a hard word to say out loud? And so they basically told her, oh, we'll let you go see him if you agree to spy for the French government. And before the war, she had performed as Mata Hari several times before the Crown Prince William, and who was the eldest son of the senior German general on the Western Front. And so they thought that because of that connection, she could obtain like some more information by seducing him for military secrets. So they're like, oh, you have a prior relationship there, so you can get us some details. However, his involvement in the whole thing was actually really minimal, and so it wouldn't have even really mattered because he wasn't really involved in the war. The main part of that misinformation was apparently the German government had a bunch of propaganda that was showing that the crown prince was like this warrior and successor to the throne, when actually he had nothing to do with it. So it was just this interesting thing. They didn't want to show him as what he really was, which was like a playboy who was an alcoholic and partied and was a womanizer and was planning on having his father declared insane and deposed. So, but Not really what they wanted, but you can't tell your entire public that when you're trying to promote a war that no one wants to be in.
Yeah, get it. I do. Yep.
Yeah. So unaware that they didn't have, that the Crown Prince didn't have much to do with running the army, they offered her 1,000,000 francs if she could seduce him and provide France with good intelligence about the German plans. So there's some critique in everything I read about them even asking her this. It's like it says, the fact that the Crown Prince had before 1914 never commanded a unit larger than a regiment and was now supposedly commanding both an army and an army group at the same time should have been a clue that the role in his German decision making was mostly nominal. So they're like, they should have known better, especially as an intelligence group, but they didn't. Yeah, so she had a contact that she reached out, and this contact actually ended up being one of her principal accusers later for her death sentence, which, not cool, dude. And he was a member of the French investigative service. In November of 1916, she was traveling from Spain aboard a steamship called Zealandia. And when the ship called the British port of Falmouth, she was arrested and taken to London, where she was interrogated at length by Sir Basil Thompson, who was the assistant commissioner at New Scotland Yard. She was arrested, taken to London. They started investigating her, and the guy who was investigating her was in charge of counter-espionage. And so he started talking about, apparently he wrote a book later, and said that she, like, eventually admitted to working for the French Bureau of Investigation, which makes sense because, like, she did. So they detained her for a while, but then they released her and just told her to stay nearby. And a full transcript of the interview is in the British National Archives and was broadcast, which I'm confused about. But I think they, like, did a broadcast of it later, like a dramatic reenactment.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Because Maudie Harry was played by Eleanor Braun on the independent station LBC in 1980. So I think they redid it. They think that there's maybe some lies within it to maybe make her story sound more intriguing. Or if the French authorities were using her in a way that they wouldn't acknowledge because they were, like, worried about international backlash. Because they basically blackmailed her to spy for them in order to let her see her boyfriend. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't really look good. They're like, oh, we'll let you break war rules if you spy for us so that you can see your wounded boyfriend.
Like, that would be damning if that came out.
Yes, exactly. So they're, like, not sure entirely what the story ended up being, because either she was trying to make her story sound better because she's arrested, or if they were trying to make their story sound better because World War I was happening. It's hard to say. Maybe a little bit of both. But so in 1916, when she was traveling to Madrid and she had gotten detained, she had been asking the German military attaché Major Kahl if he could arrange a meeting with the Crown Prince. And apparently she had offered to share French secrets with Germany in exchange for money. But they're not sure if she was just, if that was her story, if she was saying that to set up the meeting with the Crown Prince, because she had to find some way to set up a meeting with him. Or if maybe because things were going badly for her career-wise, if she was just attempting to get some more money out of this situation. I don't know. I feel like you have to lie if you're going to be a spy. So if they're mad at her for, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't really know the codes of conduct when it comes to
this. I'm like, if you're pretending, if you're spying for someone, don't you have to have a cover story? Yeah. You can't just be like, hey, I know you're in the middle of a war, but that one crown prince I danced for one time, I want to meet with him.
Yeah, I agree. It doesn't seem the most tactful way of going about it.
So I'm confused why they were like, how dare you offer to share French secrets? And it was like, what was she supposed to share? Like, what was the cover story here? Mm-hmm. I don't know. So in January of 1917, the major that she had been trying to meet with the Crown Prince through, he transmitted radio messages to Berlin and started describing helpful activities of a German spy. And the code was H-21.
Okay.
And apparently the story so closely matched hers that they were like, it could only be her. So they're like, oh, this German spy that's being really helpful is Maudie Harry. And then the French bureau intercepted the messages and they were like, crap, she's helping them.
Whoa.
Because they're like, this could only be her. Mm-hmm. And so it has to be her. And the messages were in a code that German intelligence knew had already been broken by the French, which means that the messages were contrived to have her arrested by the French.
I was just gonna say, okay.
Yeah. And so the chief intelligence officer of the German army had grown very annoyed that Maudie Harry had provided him with no intelligence worthy of the name, instead of selling the Germans mere Paris gossip about the sex lives of French politicians and generals, and decided to terminate her employment by exposing her as a German spy to the French. So basically, she didn't give him good enough secrets, so he's fine. Then I'll have the French arrest you by pretending that you're a German spy. That's been very helpful. So she just got set up.
Yeah, gosh.
Yeah, but I guess they didn't see that at the time, or if they were just upset and embarrassed about the whole thing. So in December of 1916, after she had been arrested, the Bureau of the French War Ministry let her obtain the names of 6 Belgian agents, and 5 were subjected of submitting fake material and working for the Germans, and the 6th was suspected of being a double agent for Germany and France. Mm-hmm. And so 2 weeks after she had left Paris for the trip to Spain, the Germans executed the double agent while the 5 others continued their operations. And so this development proved that Maudie Harry had communicated the names of the 6 spies to the Germans. So they were like, she knew the names, and then this person had died, and it was after she had left, so the only way that it could have been was if it was her. But we literally just talked about how the Germans set her up because they didn't have any useful information either. So
yeah.
It seems so a little fishy. I'm finding some holes in these stories.
I'm finding a lot of holes. Absolutely. Yeah.
So she was arrested once again in her hotel room and then tried on the 24th of July, accused of spying for Germany and consequently causing the deaths of at least 50,000 soldiers. Which, where did you get that statistic if they said that all she gave them was Paris gossip?
This is very sad.
Yeah.
This is not making me feel good. This is horrible.
And although French and British intelligence suspected her of spying for Germany, neither could produce definite evidence against her. She actually said herself during the trial, a harlot, yes, but a traitress, never. Oh. So she was basically like, you can call me whatever you want, but I am not a traitor to my country.
Put that on a t-shirt.
Right?
Honestly.
A harlot, yes. The traitress,
never.
Oh, the principal interrogator also grilled her relentlessly, and he also was the one who prosecuted her at trial, which I feel like that's not allowed.
Yeah,
the investigator to be the prosecutor feels a little strange.
Yeah, I don't really know how that works, but yeah. I agree. It feels wrong.
Yeah, one of the things that they like really threw her direction during the whole trial was that like her story of Maudie Harry as a person was invented. So they're like, well, you're not a Javanese princess. You're Dutch. And so therefore, you're dishonest. And therefore, we can't trust you. So you're a spy.
That is a leap in... Sure,
I
like,
know. From like
as
a,
we discussed,
a stage
like
persona.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just horrible.
So she actually like admitted to some things during the trial. She admitted that she had accepted 20,000 francs from a German diplomat and former lover as reimbursement for belongings being taken from her by German authorities. So she was like, they took all my stuff, and so he offered me money to replace it, and so I took it. But that's not a payment for secrets. That's, hey, sorry that you lost all of your clothing. Here's some money. And so they started claiming that was actually just payment for her spying for Germany, and that was like her cover story. And then in the meantime, the French had also been preparing a case against her by casting all of her activities in the worst possible light, going as far as to engage in evidence tampering. So they were trying to set her up hardcore.
Gosh.
And that's where it comes that she's probably a scapegoat, because it's like, why?
Yeah,
why this random woman?
Well, that's also what I'm thinking. It's World War I. It just seems to me there are more important problems going on in the world right now
Why are we so focused in on this girl?
I know, right? Woman? Just like some random exotic dancer who's in love with one of the soldiers and they're like her.
And wanted to see him. Like, it seems so strange.
It was like, why would they try so hard to frame her? Mm-hmm. Basically, from what I could find is that in 1917, so when all of this was happening, France had been shaken by great mutinies of the French army in the spring of that time. And so there was like a huge strike that was going on and mutiny was happening within their own war. And people were literally believing that French was going to collapse because of war exhaustion. So they can't handle it anymore. It's been going on for too long. Like, they're just going to fall apart. Like, they were literally terrified that they would lose their entire country. And so in this context, if they could have one German spy that they could blame everything that went wrong with the war on, then that would make it like more agreeable with the public. So they would be like, see all these issues they've had with the war? It's actually this one woman's fault.
It was because she did that. It had nothing to do with what we did wrong.
Yes. Nothing else went wrong. It was all her. She sold our secrets to Germany. And therefore, everything that went wrong was because of her.
Gosh.
This kind of led to the public just eviscerating her without knowing all of the details. The French press, basically, her whole trial and everything got maximum publicity. Like, we're talking OJ trial levels. Like, just ridiculous amounts of publicity. They started treating it like she had been one of the most important spies in the entire war effort, when not
it
even
doesn't
close.
Seem like that's true at all. Yeah.
No, like, not at all. So they started like really exaggerating her role in everything. The Canadian historian Wesley Wark stated in a 2014 interview that Maudie Hare was never an important spy, but a scapegoat for French military failures, which she had nothing to do with, stating they needed a scapegoat and she was a notable target for scapegoating. So it just, she was vulnerable and it worked out. Likewise, the British historian Julie Wheelwright stated she really did not pass on anything that you couldn't find in the local newspapers in Spain. She went on to describe her as an independent woman, a divorcee, a citizen of a neutral country, a courtesan, and a dancer, which made her the perfect scapegoat for the French, who were then losing the war. And she was held up as an example of what might happen to you if you had too loose of morals. Look at this courtesan dancer who ruined everything, and that's what would happen to you. Just not great. Of course, like, she knew she was innocent, so she wrote several letters to the Dutch ambassador in Paris claiming her innocence, like being like, hey, help. She said, my international connections are due of my work as a dancer, nothing else, because I really did not spy. It is terrible that I cannot defend myself. The most horrible part of all of this is that her lover, Maslov.
I was just going to ask, where is the love of her life?
Yeah. So he's been really embittered because of combat. And like they said, the war effort was exhausting and he was on the front lines and he lost his eye. So he has all of this going on. And I'm sure it'd been like a long time since they'd even seen each other because of everything. And so he refused to testify for her and told her that he did not care if she was convicted or not.
And she did this all for him.
I know. And they said when she heard that from him, she passed out.
Wow.
Her defense counsel was like a veteran international lawyer named Edward Clunet. And he tried really hard, but literally the situation was impossible. They had already set her up. And so it was never on her side. He wasn't allowed to cross-examine the prosecution's witnesses. He wasn't allowed to examine his witnesses directly. There was no court procedure going on here that was fair. This was not justice at all. Like, not allowing him to cross-examine witnesses? Are you kidding me? That is a basic fundamental of courtroom procedure. And they're like, nope. They also, like, the prosecutor used the fact that she was a woman as evidence of her guilt and literally said, without scruples, accustomed to making use of men, she is the type of woman who is born to be a spy. Yeah, And that kind of led to this idea of her as this femme fatale, right? A dangerous, seductive woman uses her sexuality to manipulate men. But American historians have come forward now and they've been like, no, she was naive, easily duped, a victim rather than a victimizer.
She was in love and was willing to do anything to see the person she loved.
Yeah, she called him the lover of her life. She wanted to see him. He had been injured. And so she agreed. And then they were like, oh, we're just going to blame you for everything because it's convenient.
Oh, my gosh. I'm so unsettled. Yeah. This is like that's not the word, obviously, to describe it.
But, yeah.
That's so gross.
Yeah. And like I said, the media was just not fair. There was like all of these news reports that said that she had admitted to spying for Germany. She never said that. She never made any admission about that. She maintained throughout her entire ordeal that she had never been a German spy. She vehemently insisted that her sympathies were with the Allies, declared passionate love of France, her adopted homeland. That's where she ended up finding her successful career. And she loved France. Like, she wouldn't have done that. And by October 2001, so like way too late, documents were released from the archives of the British counterintelligence. And they were used by a Dutch group called the Maud Heyre Foundation to ask the French government to exonerate her because they proved with the files that she was not guilty of the charges she was convicted for. Mm-hmm. And a spokesperson from the Maud Heyre Foundation argued that at most she was a low-level spy who provided no secrets to either side, stating, "We believe that there are sufficient doubts concerning the dossier of information that was used to convict her to warrant reopening the case. Maybe she wasn't entirely innocent, but it seems clear she wasn't the master spy whose information sent thousands of soldiers to their deaths as has been."
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if she actually got acquitted. Basically, it's accepted now by the majority of the public that she's not guilty, but I don't think they ever actually got rid of it.
Wow.
Yeah, they declassified the documents, which was a total of 1,275 pages in 2017, 100 years after her execution, were unsealed. But I don't think she actually was officially acquitted.
I just Googled it because I was curious. And fun fact, you can go to cia.gov/readingroom, and there is something from 1985 that says Maud Heyre was framed. Files show, and it literally is one PDF that like it feels like it's just illegal that I'm on this. It's not at all, because you can just go to cia.gov apparently.
That's so random.
Yeah, interesting.
Gosh, yeah, that's crazy. So we'll talk about her execution, because that's what's next. She was executed by a firing squad that consisted of 12 French soldiers just before dawn on the 15th of October in 1917. She was only 41.
Wow.
And according to an eyewitness account, this makes me love her more, she was not bound. She refused a blindfold.
Wow.
And she blew a kiss to the firing squad before they killed her.
I mean, if this injustice is done to you, you gotta.
I know. I'm like, I guess go out the best way you can. She wore a neat Amazonian tailored suit that was especially made for the occasion, got a dress with style, and a pair of new white gloves. That was according to one account. Another one did say that she wore the same suit, low-cut blouse, and tricorn ensemble that had been picked out by her accusers for her to wear at trial, which was the only clean outfit she had in prison. Neither of these matched photographic evidence. Which I didn't see any photographs of it, so I don't know.
It's interesting how what she's worn has
become. I know. They're like more focused on that. If it was a man, would they have cared? Probably not. But anyway, so there was all this debate about what she wore. And then at the end, they said, after the volley of shots rang out, slowly, inertly, she settled to her knees, her head up always without the slightest change of expression on her face. For a fraction of a second, it seems she tottered there on her knees, gazing directly at those who had taken her life, and then she fell backward, bending at the waist with her legs doubled up beneath her. A non-commissioned officer then walked up to her body, pulled out his revolver, and shot her again to make sure she was dead, which I think is pretty common.
Yeah.
an article did say, I think it was in the newspaper, it said death comes to Mahdi Hari. Mahdi Hari's body was not claimed by any family members, and she was accordingly used for medical study. Her head was embalmed and kept in the Museum of Anatomy in Paris. And in 2000, archivists discovered that it had disappeared, possibly as early as 1954, during the museum's relocation. And her head is still missing. Mm-hmm. So that's really fun. And also, the records dated in 1918 show that the museum also received the rest of her body, and they don't know where that is either.
Oh, that makes me almost want to cry. That makes me so upset. Because it's just, first off, like, this insane injustice that's done. She doesn't even have autonomy, like, in her death.
Yep.
Oh.
And I'm like, used for medical study is very different from being sent off to a museum. I'm sorry. Like, Museum of Anatomy. And,
like, her head involved. Like, oh, like, that just seems like some,
like, you did that because she was a sex symbol. Yeah. So that's messed up. Yeah, and they lost all of it, so they don't have any of it. Ooh, like I said, they declassified all of the files, so now we know she's innocent. And they do have a Mahdi Hari room in the Frisian Museum in the Netherlands. And included in it are two of her personal scrapbooks with an oriental rug embroidered with the footsteps of her fan dance that she was really famous for. And then in her native town, the museum is well known for researching the life and career of their world-famous citizen, of course. And so they had the largest ever Mahdi Hari exhibition 100 years after her death in 2017 to honor her. But because of the whole idea of exotic dancer working as a lethal double agent, that's obviously shown up in so many things in popular culture, and that is attributed to her. As well as the idea of using seduction to extract military secrets from many lovers. That's also another archetype. Like I said, she became this figure of the femme fatale that they used, even though it's sad because the story's not even true. Yeah. She didn't actually do any of that.
They took advantage of the fact that she was doing, of the work she was doing, because they're like, oh, this is an easy target. This is a story that we can craft and people will not be excited about the story, but they'll be willing to latch on to it.
Yeah. They literally saw someone on the fringe of society. Cause they're like, you're a divorcee, you lost custody of your daughter, you're an exotic dancer. Yeah. He works as a courtesan. So we're just going to use you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they did.
Brutal.
So she's inspired a lot of films. Obviously, they have a bunch of movies about her. They also have, she shows up a lot of the times in other movies, like people being her. And then also, like I said, just inspiring other characters as well. Like even this, she was in the Young Indiana Jones Chronicles as the person who took his virginity. When it's like, what the heck? Who came up with that idea? It's just so weird. And then they also, she's inspired at least 5 stage musicals too.
Wow.
And a lot of songs as well, where they have a lot of songs about her. But yeah, it's just like this insane story of a complete injustice done because they could.
Because they could. And because there was nothing like there to protect her.
Yeah, nothing at all. So yeah, that's Mahdi Hari.
That's a horrible story, but I am so glad that you told it.
Yeah, she was such a prominent figure to go on to, like, how many things she's inspired. And I just think that it's not fair. High art, low art, however you want to look at it, it doesn't give you an excuse to frame someone for the murder of 50,000 people and put them to death.
Yeah, I think it, and unfortunately, too, I don't know if those attitudes have changed for people.
Oh, definitely not.
Like, I don't know. It's with, like, true crime shows where it's like, oh, like, prostitutes are getting murdered, and it just seems, oh, that's just what can happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
As opposed to being like, no, like, women are getting murdered and crimes being committed to sex workers are, like, legit. You know, I'll admit that I don't know a lot about it, and I don't have, like, specific numbers or, you know what I mean, like, stats to, like, back up here, but I do know that is a legitimate problem.
Oh, it's a huge thing.
So it's, like, sad to realize that, like, it doesn't seem like it's maybe changed that much.
No. The police literally call it, like, a high-risk or low-risk victim.
Mm.
If you have a job like that, you're considered high risk. Like, they basically almost say that it's like more likely that something like that would happen to you. So it's like mm-hmm. less surprising. And therefore, they're like
differently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Nature of the job situation. Whereas I think both of us would be considered low risk victims because what do I do besides go to work and go home?
Yeah. Like, same.
yeah. So like if I ended up murdered, they'd be like, what the heck? Like, how did mm-hmm. that happen? But that's not fair to like, yeah, there's so many things like no one asks to get murdered. And that's not fair to assume that. And I know that's been a lot of debates with like people having issues with OnlyFans. But then I'm being like, that's one of the safest ways for people actually to make yeah. money in sex work nowadays. And it's just a very interesting thing that a woman who had to do that is a way to survive. And mm-hmm. yeah, I'm sure she enjoyed the dancing. Like, she picked it up as a hobby. But then to kind of
be still
first,
I think it's a really good yeah. point is the reason why she did is because she, like you said, you described her situation. Like, it's what led her down the path that she did. And then it was totally used against her when, yeah.
All for love.
All for love. Oh my gosh. An important story to tell, of course.
I agree.
Yeah, thank you for
also,
learning about her.
I'm ready for another movie about her.
Yeah.
Right?
I want to look up what's available out there.
I know. I think the other ones are like black and white. Like, it was a 1920 film that was done about her. And then it looks like 1927 and 1931. So I don't think there's been like a... Oh, maybe there was one in 20... Oh, yeah. They just said a sex icon becomes a spy during one of the most important wars of the 20th century. She... Wrong story.
She doesn't become a spy.
No.
Sure, it's a great story, but it's not the real story.
It's not true. Yeah, and we've talked about people who were spies or like double agents during certain times, like Afra Behn. People who did intelligence work because women were considered like more invisible during those times. They could get away with things, but like, that was not her. All she knew was some Paris gossip. She just wanted to see her boyfriend.
Gosh. Thank you, everyone, for being here and listening to the story. I should have saved the Chapel Roan merch shout out for the end so we could end on a happy note.
Yeah, end on a happy one.
Regardless, though, thank you for being here and listening. And if you're a fan of the podcast, of course, you know what to do. It would be great if you wanted to rate a review. Make sure you're following us and everything. And also, if you think that there's someone out there who would, I don't know, feel this righteous anger by listening to this story, and perhaps that's something that could fuel them to send them the episode, and so you can make sure more people know about the story.
I will say my favorite thing about these stories, even though they're sad and frustrating, is also just seeing the way they hold their dignity to the end. Even if the fashion part of it's fake, or her blowing a kiss, or the way that the guy describes how she held her head high until they knew they were innocent. And so they stood for that the whole time. And it's like, okay, there's something to be said for that. That we have great examples of women before us that even when injustice was done to them, they like held their head high. And
absolutely. Anyways, Well, we'll be back next week with another episode. Yes. And we are here every Monday for More Than a Muse Monday. So
yes,
come back.
See you next time.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.